So there are some things that just tend to make me smile, that lift my spirits. Babies, for example, or flowers in bloom, or rainbows are another. Rainbows are beautiful, a spectrum of color on a background of dark clouds. And when we see a rainbow, we want to take pictures. We want to invite others to come and look and see it too. We want to share the experience. And babies and flowers and rainbows, all of these things give us a sense of hope. They speak to the potential inside of us, of the possibilities of the future. Rainbows remind us that the sun is still there, even on a rainy day. Now, many of us know the story of Noah. God tells him to build an ark so that he and his families and some animals will be saved when God, excuse me, so that they'll all be saved when God destroys the earth with a flood. And we might wonder, well, did this story really happen? It's kind of an incredible story. It gives us lots of reason to doubt, of course. But many ancient cultures, other than the Israelites, also had stories of great floods. So maybe these stories are rooted in some kind of historical remembrance. But I think the point of Noah's story certainly is not historical accuracy. This is a story similar to the creation story that asks questions about God's nature and our relationship with the divine. And even so, it's not really my favorite story. The God portrayed is not how I know God. I would reject the idea that a God of love can also be a God of destruction. But I accept that the people of Noah's time, the people who were originally telling this story, maybe did understand God in that way. They were trying to find meaning behind tragedy, as we do. And their conclusion seems to be that God must be punishing them for something. Now, like I said, that's not my understanding. I don't believe that a loving God would ever approve of or wish for genocide. And it's a little scary, I think, that we use that story of Noah as a story for children. For me, God doesn't cause the tragedies of life, but walks with us through them, loving us and giving us the strength and the courage that we need to find new life on the other side. And I find it interesting that those ancient people didn't seem perhaps totally comfortable with God as destruction either. Because we're told that after the great flood, God established a covenant with all the earth that it will never again be destroyed by flood. Instead, it will be nurtured and loved. It's kind of like God is saying, oops, I went a little too far. And I promise not to do that again. And so God places the rainbow in the sky as a sign of the covenant and as a reminder that when things are cloudy and not going so well, don't strike out in violence, but stop and turn instead toward love and support. And so the rainbow becomes a symbol of new life and hope in the midst of tragedy. It becomes a promise that things will be different in the future and a reminder of a covenant between God and us. Now, a covenant is a little bit similar to a contract. It's a promise. It's an agreement. But it's also more than those things. A contract says, I'll do X if you do Y. And a covenant kind of says, well, I'll do X and you'll do Y. It's the difference between if and. And that's a subtle, but I think important distinction. A contract is a transaction, often between strangers. But a covenant implies ongoing mutual relationship. And it even has an element of the sacred in it. And so God makes a covenant, a description of ongoing relationship. And God does this not just with Noah and Noah's descendants, but with every living thing, with all of creation as we know it. God promises relationship and a new way of doing things. God doesn't desire destruction, but wants creation to flourish. God doesn't desire relationship with only humans, but with every living creature, the entire earth. This is a radically inclusive God. And so the rainbow also reminds us to welcome everyone. In this hopeful covenant of new life and new ways of welcome, comes sandwiched between the story of the great flood, time of destruction, and the story of Noah's son, Ham, which if you don't know, you can go and read. But it's the story of Ham has unfortunately been used as theological support for all kinds of oppression against various minority groups, including the enslavement of African people. And so God's covenant is a promise of love and support, a rainbow against dark clouds, and it literally cuts through the middle of stories about natural tragedy and human cruelty, promising a better life, a new and better tomorrow. It's a covenant which doesn't justify tragedy and cruelty, but stands in contrast to them. It says this is not what God desires for God's creation. And it should not only remind us of the divine promise of new life, but remind us not to become desensitized to the genocide and disasters of our world today. God calls us not just to hope for a better tomorrow, but to live into that hope. I think that is our part of the covenant. And in our gospel reading, Jesus declares, this is the time of fulfillment. The reign of God is at hand. We're to live as if that new tomorrow, the reign of God, is here now. We're not to live in denial of tragedy and cruelty in our lives, but to work toward healing in the present and living in more loving ways in the future. Working not in destructive ways, but to nourish all life. All living things. And that juxtaposition of the rainbow covenant with Jesus' declaration that the time of fulfillment is here might make us ask if Jesus is the fulfillment of God's covenant to provide a new way of doing things. In today's gospel reading, Mark, the author, covers a lot in just a couple of verses. Jesus is baptized, named and claimed as God's beloved, another kind of covenant between Jesus and God. And then Jesus is immediately driven by the Spirit into the wilderness. And there's a sense of urgency there. Mark is moving the story along quickly. Everything happens immediately. And he even uses that word more than once, immediately, immediately. He wants us to act now. Things need to happen. And his account only gives us two sentences about this wilderness period, but they're significant. He simply says that Jesus was there for 40 days being tempted, and he was looked after by angels. We can imagine that he was tempted to forget his calling from God, his true self, tempted to leave God's path. After all, he probably had a good idea of where that path was leading. Not too many people challenged the oppression of Rome and came out unscathed. But God did not abandon Jesus in his period of doubt and temptation, this period of preparation for his ministry to come. Mark tells us he was looked after by angels. And then Jesus emerges from the wilderness to proclaim the good news, new life in the love of God. Jesus' ministry was about bringing us new life, a better tomorrow, a new way of being that focuses on nurture and love rather than the threats and violence of the world. In a way, this is the same covenant that God makes in Genesis, the promise of a new way that nurtures instead of destroying. And we see a pattern here. Jesus was baptized, symbolically washing away the influences of the world's ways and being filled with the nurturing energy of the Spirit. And then he goes into a time of preparation, a wilderness period, and emerges into his new ministry, a time of new life and new growth. And that's what it means to walk God's path. And we see it in the story of Noah. The flood washes away the old, what wasn't working anymore, and is followed by a period of preparation on the ark, getting ready for a new life, for a new creation. And finally, a new relationship between God and creation is established, God's promise of life and not death. In these stories, there's a certain rhythm of walking God's path to new life. God's way begins with a cleansing of sorts, a baptism or some kind of turning from the world's old way of violence to a new life in God's love, where God names and claims us as God's beloved, establishing a sacred covenant. And then comes a wilderness period, a time of preparation and struggle before we finally emerge into new life, walking with God in hope and peace and justice. And I think this is the rhythm of Lent and Easter as well. An invitation to turn to God, changing hearts and minds. And then 40 days of preparation, drawing closer to God, reflecting on who we are, whose we are, why we are, and then emerging into new life with the resurrection. And that we do this every year recognizes the fact that this is always an ongoing process that repeats itself many times during our lives as we choose to take steps ever closer to the divine presence. During Lent this year, I invite us to think of that rainbow and be reminded to nurture and not destroy. Be reminded to welcome and care for all of God's children, all of God's creation. And be reminded that there is new, renewed life on the way. I invite us to remember God's covenant of this new way, made in Genesis, renewed in Jesus. And in the midst of tragedy and cruelty that surround us, let us remember the rainbow and have hope, rejecting the ways of the world and turning toward God in preparation for a new way, new life. There's a prayer that I've used in past seasons of Lent, and I invite us to make it our prayer again this Lent, this year. And it goes, you might recognize it as I read it, but it goes, O God, prepare us for new life. Wash away the obstacles that prevent growth. Nourish our body and soul and fill us with the Spirit. O God, prepare us for new life. Look after us in the crucible of difficult times. Show us what we no longer need. Let us see what might be. Remembering God's covenant of a new way, may God give us the strength and courage as God's beloved children, God's hands and feet and voice on this earth to create God's kingdom of love and peace, hope and justice in our lives. Amen.